Sunday.
That means it's Q Report. I'm really pissed off at Meet the Press for taking that from us, even though they got it before and have the rights to that line. Well, they should have saved it for us.
Who watches the Meet the Press anyway?
Well, I mean, Tim Russert was a big guy. I mean, I found him very good. We were actually talking about him last week.
Yeah, here's what I have to say about Tim Russert.
By the way,
where was he when Dick Cheney was prostating the war on his show, and he was like, and he didn't want to speak up because he didn't want to lose the access. That's what I say about Tim Russert, who, in my hometown, is a big hero. They're making statues to him, but
I can't imagine that he was not tough on Cheney.
Well, when it was time for him to speak up and point out the obvious, you know, Cheney came on classically to, endorse the Times articles. The very things that they were planting by unknown sources in the Times, they came on to endorse on Meet the Press. So, and Tim Russert was aware of that. And, of course, he was aware of that during the whole trial when she was put into... Mark, what was the writer's name?
Judith Miller.
Judith Miller, of course.
That's why I like not knowing anything about anyone. I want to know them for their talent and what they should be judged
Tim
for.
Tim Russert, he had a great, television voice.
Like John, but he wasn't of high moral standing.
I meaning when push came to shove, he got pushed. That's my point. Meaning when it really mattered, as opposed to Cronkite, who we're talking about, when push came to shove, he spoke up.
How often did he really speak up? I asked that question, every show he would have an opinion.
Exactly, this is exactly the point. He wasn't an opinionator.
Right.
He just did it, and when he did it, it has resonance because it wasn't a bloviator. Yeah, exactly.
He did it when it mattered.
When it mattered.
Well, like Johnny Carson, I know he was famous for never having gone to the White House. No matter what, he never won
president.
I like that, need to see him
running
around
Hollywood. Didn't he go to see
Reagan?
No, he didn't see Reagan?
Are you implying that Johnny Carson is a conservative?
No, just that, a lot of entertainers go to the White House regardless of who's in office. Was Elvis a conservative? He famously met with Nixon.
Really?
But, I would be surprised if he didn't. Because Carson was an icon like that. There's no question.
I think it's okay to visit your president, Bush towards the end, you're being a patriot.
Right, of course. I mean, it's his job. It's like, just because you show up at the White House doesn't mean you're endorsing it or not endorsing it.
Right.
People did make that point.
Well, we have a really interesting show.
We
are talking about Betty Page.
Betty Page. For all you Betty Page fans out there, we know there's millions in the legions of Betty Page fans.
Hold on. Let's give the guys a chance to get out of the conversation, walk to the bedroom. We were talking about Betty Page. No, I know that's not what she's about, but she was hot stuff. And because it was refined and reserved, it made it all the more sexy.
Well, also, what's really fascinating, and we have the document. There's a new documentary coming out. We have the filmmaker here, Mark Moore, who's a good friend of mine and a producer. We've worked together recently. And her story is really fascinating, and we've sort of through the Producers Guild also I've sort of seen it develop this documentary, and it's pretty fascinating actually. It's not cliche in any way. Where you think it might turn, it turns completely in the opposite way. So she's a total iconoclast, literally from beginning to end. I mean, she doesn't fit any mold, and still doesn't, and nobody really followed her. I mean, they're still copying her from the 50s, which is when she stopped. In any case, then we also have Chris P.
To start a new Parakini, to start a series. It's going to be a recurring segment. I think part of our Heritage Radio Network listeners are going to hear moving in the direction of recurring themes for each show. So this is New York Waterways. We wanted to start from the beginning. This is how the New World was found, via its waterways. So it's our first segment.
And we did talk about that on one of our earlier shows.
Yeah, we did. Water is very important.
Yeah, regarding the East River, and regarding the prison ship monument in Fort Greene Park.
Yeah.
To all those people who were killed and died, 11,000, more than the Revolutionary War, in the East River. And all those bones that washed up, and Walt Whitman, the famous American poet, who said we should make a monument to these people who are, because the British kind of dumped them into the East River.
Ooh, it would have been so great to have Walt Whitman on. He was alive during radio.
Yeah, he might have been. I don't think so.
He was considered the first great American poet. Like, Americans always had this insecurity complex with Europe, so they were always waiting for their first great artist, their first great poet, their first great conductor. And I think Emerson and Thoreau must have been
born there,
or they weren't poets. They were essayists.
Whitman was born here in Brooklyn.
Yeah,
New
Jersey. Considered the first. Mm-hmm. Leaves of Grass. We should read from Leaves of Grass.
I would love that. It's fantastic. It's very New York.
Right in Naval Yards.
Yeah.
So, let's take a break, and we will come back talking about an American icon from someone who knew her.
Betty Page and Mark Morey.
We actually have a new sponsor.
Oh, wow. Who is it?
We had a new sponsor for the first show of the day, and today's sponsors is Paradise Locker Meats, an unbelievable abattoir and slaughterhouse in Trimble, Missouri, just outside of Kansas City, and they generally invested in our flashing logo sponsorship.
Fantastic. Well, they are lucky to be on our show, and so we're lucky to have them. Thank you so much. So we're coming back to, we're going to be talking to Mark Morey, documentarian. He has a new documentary coming out in the fall release, or planned for the fall, kind of a grassroots distribution model, which we'll talk about too. Mark, welcome to Heritage Network Studios here at Bushwick, Brooklyn.
Oh, thanks, Mark and Patrick. It's great to be here with you guys.
Thanks for being here.
So Mark Morey, just to give a little background, Mark Morey is I've known for some time now through the Producers Guild, but Mark is an Academy Award nominated documentarian, and our interests have sort of paralleled in an odd way. That particular documentary that he was up for that year in 91, I think it was 91?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Barbara Koppel won for American Dream, which is another fantastic, what a fantastic year for docs. But tell us about that doc, Mark, the one that you were nominated for, because it had a parallel interest that I had, ironically, with H-Bomb in the same area.
Well, it was called Building Bombs, and it was about a nuclear weapons factory in South Carolina. And it was about actually the guy who was in charge of radioactive waste management for the Department of Energy sacrificed his career in order to expose just the massive, unbelievable radioactive waste contamination that they were just dumping millions of gallons and tons of radioactive waste in the backyard there in South Carolina.
Wow. Is he still alive, that guy?
Yeah.
We should have him on.
But the footage, if you haven't seen it, it's available. Building Bombs is available on DVD.
Netflix, Amazon, anywhere.
Yeah, what was that guy's name, if I can ask?
Bill Lawless.
Big Lawless. Great name.
He can't make that up.
No.
You can't make it up. But the footage he has in there, which we talked about, and we discussed the documentary that I did on America's Lost H-Bomb, which is in the same, where this plant is in the Savannah River plant. The Savannah River goes through into Georgia, actually, which is where it's polluting, leaching into the river. I was thinking, oh, this could be my next doc. And, of course, Mark had already done it 10 years earlier.
It's one of the key nuclear bomb factories in the U.S.
Yeah,
like it still exists.
Yes.
Yeah, it still exists. I don't think they're not making
bombs anymore.
Not anymore. They just have the joy of the refuse. But the amazing footage in that documentary, which I asked, it's like Mark literally shows bulldozers with cardboard box says, and it says radioactive material. They're literally putting it in a ditch.
Well, they're just pushing a whole big load of cardboard boxes into a ditch that say radioactive waste on
that
it.
That is so old school.
I asked him if it was like reenactment.
That's tough footage to get nowadays.
Yeah, exactly.
They're so careful because they're helicopters, bugs.
Well, they actually gave that footage to me by mistake. I didn't shoot that. Yeah. That came out of their archives.
Oh, Lord.
That's fantastic.
Were there a bunch of guys drinking beers in a boardroom, like, doing the intro?
Yeah, well, they're like, they're closing us down anyway. Who cares, I suppose. But, yeah, it's fantastic.
So then where did you go from there? I mean, after that documentary, did you come?
Mark, that was pretty close to
that
your
was
first,
my first,
first out of the gate. Pretty
really?
Good.
Really?
Yeah. Academy Award nomination.
And had you studied documentary filmmaking?
I did 1 year of film school, but basically, and didn't really learn that much there, just basically found the idea for this film and said, you know, I just want to go make it.
So what advice would you give to the kids out there for, you know, coming up with an idea? I mean, what did it take? I mean, it must have been such a big part of your life.
This was shot on film and it took me 5 years and it was before all the video that we have now. But what I would say is just get out there and do it. Just get out there and start shooting, start editing. You can do it all on your desktop with a handheld camera. It's
There's really no right way to do it, as we're going to talk about with Betty Page, speaking of which is like a whole nother model, if you can even call it that, of what you're doing with that. Tell us about Betty Page, of course, is the famous iconoclast. People think of her as a pinup girl and sex kitten and S&M, sadomasochism, bondage. Right. But, I mean, back in the day, considered sort of radical at the time. I mean, if you look at her pictures, they look like, you know.
Here this.
I mean, now they look like you could see there. I mean, there's ads in Vogue that are far more dicey than that. But tell us how you came about upon that subject.
Well, actually, this is going to sound funny. My lawyer was her lawyer's lawyer.
Wow, a match made in heaven by New York standards.
shout out for the lawyers.
So the story about how I got connected with her is not that interesting, although I did meet her in 1996, become friends with her, conducted a series of interviews with her. And, you know, for people who don't know who she is, she's probably the greatest pinup model in history. She's more popular today than ever. Among young people, she's more popular than Marilyn Monroe, gets more hits on her official website than Marilyn Monroe does on her official website.
Wow.
And
what is it about her? What was it? I mean, obviously it was the whole package, everything, but I mean, what would you really attribute such a just innate sexual attraction by millions of people around the globe?
Well, and it's a sexual attraction that holds up even today, seems very modern. You could summarize it maybe as the naughty girl next door.
Oh.
She's so natural in front of the camera, the best model ever in front of a still camera.
Well, that's pretty interesting you bring that up because as I know a lot about it, but she had a natural, I mean, for her it wasn't really, for her it was really play and like her joy of it sort of comes out of it, out through it. Tell us a little bit about her life and how she got into it, which is pretty fascinating, actually.
Well, she was she moved to New York as a single woman in 1949 and just was discovered on the beach in Coney Island by a black policeman, said, have you ever been photographed? Would you like to be a model? So he photographed her and basically got her.
That guy's awesome.
They've been doing that.
He was a Brooklyn policeman.
Am I wearing this? I'm really a photographer.
They've been doing that since 1949, that same line. It's amazing.
I know. It's still where it's never quite worked like
but
that.
But he actually did photograph for... There were these kind of pulpy, girly magazines, no nudity back in those days, called things like Flirt, Wink, Beauty Parade.
Would have girls too risque.
Girls in bathing suits and bikinis and stuff. But of course, bikinis then were, you never saw them in reality.
Right.
So she got into doing these kind of cheesecake photos, kind of fell into it. And her attitude was, I can make more doing that 2 hours a week than I can working as a secretary.
Absolutely. More power to her. Did she have cohorts, I mean, at that time? Were there other women doing similar things, but maybe not as famously?
There's plenty of other women did that in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at some of the old pictures, boy, Betty just jumps off the page in a way that they don't. I mean, we don't know their names now. There's a couple that some people, aficionados, know, but Betty Page is bigger now than she was then.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. And maybe it was, I think it was her attitude, but also she had a very unique physique, specifically.
Yes. Well, we have one of the most prolific and well-known photographers of Betty Page by the name of Bunny Yeager, who took...
It's a great name, too.
Yeah, and she was a model before she was a photographer. She got Betty Page into Playboy in the first year of Playboy in 1955.
Ooh, she was the first year of Playboy,
yeah.
Huh?
Yeah, and...
it's historic.
So Bunny talks about how tiny Betty's waist was, and it was really... That was the key to her figure.
Right.
Her physique was the tiny waist. It doesn't look like her boobs are that big, but with the tiny waist, she has this really shapely, sexy figure, and that's one of the key things about her.
Can we, now that, you've aroused some interest, could we hear her voice?
Yes.
Can we, is it too early to play just to get some of the feel as we talk more?
There's a little story that she can tell about her days in New York.
Ooh. Every year in New York, they'd have the artist ball. They have a contest for the best costume. And guess what I was wearing? Just two telephone dials, one over this breast, one over this, and a suggestion box, and black net stockings up to the waist, and that was it. And I won it that year.
So,
and I got a whole set.
So what she's talking about, I mean, this is pretty risque for those days. This was in the 50s. She goes to a costume party with just a telephone dial over each breast, basically a bikini, and a awesome suggestion box, and she obviously won the costume contest. So.
But tell us about the interview you conducted with her. She had very specific criteria.
Well, if you notice, her voice sounds kind of deep and gruff, and she has a strong Southern drawl. She's from Nashville, Tennessee, and so it's not the kind of voice you would necessarily associate.
And you would think that she'd be rich beyond her dreams because everybody loves her, knows her, but she has a little bit of a twist of tragedy even back then.
Well, she in 1957, after being persecuted by the Democratic presidential candidate who won the most electoral votes in 1956, Estes Kefauver, who ended up being the vice presidential candidate with Adlai Stevenson. He brought her before a Senate committee for corrupting the morals of America. A kind of a McCarthyism of sex, I call it.
Mm-hmm. Jesus, where are all my... there's this one. This isn't very, well thought out. But... It's very unfortunate. God, I mean, all these... there was such a fear
That's
of...
politics.
This was basically... They were persecuting her for bondage photographs. No nudity, no sex, no men in the pictures.
Describe, just for people who aren't
she
familiar.
She has maybe she has a whip in her hand, she's wrestling another woman, fully clothed, with a bathing suit on or something. But
it's tall patent leather boots.
Right.
Fishnet stockings.
And so this was, in the 50s, this was worse than being gay.
Now let me ask you, how do feminist groups view her?
Well, it's interesting because some consider her a precursor of the sexual revolution.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of young women today, which you could, I guess, say in a post-feminist era, really identify with Betty as an alternative to the kind of narrow supermodel Barbie doll kind of mainstream definition of sexuality. So a lot of women identify with her.
So Mark, actually, that's a really interesting point. Talk about, and we could, I could list them, but talk about the women who you would know today who have sort of, like Sherilyn Fenn and some people who have sort of embraced her look and that are popular even today, at least for a period.
Well, a big fan of Betty is Kim Cattrall from the...
Right.
Sex in the City. Show.
Right. Yeah, she's a big fan of Betty Page.
So did she model her... I mean, so it was very sensual
all the time.
Well,
she had a big influence on Paris fashion. Oh. Christy Turlington, all these models dressed like Betty.
They would wear phone dials.
Jean-Paul Gaultier.
And Madonna took her look, you know, when she's wearing the lingerie, the cone bras taken directly from Betty Page.
Yeah. Was she alive to experience that type of recognition?
Yeah, Betty
and respect?
Page just died this past December. Wow. A lot of people didn't even know she was still alive. Yeah. She completely disappeared after this persecution in 1957, not to be heard from for 40 years.
Really? So these were just a few photos during a short period of time.
Well, no, she's probably the most photographed model of the 20th century.
Just within those 2 years?
Yes, probably 20,000 photographs of her.
It's pretty interesting. She talk about the photograph
did
clubs
she still,
too.
I mean, sorry to ask such a superficial question, but did she remain beautiful? I mean, did that take the wind out of her sails, or was her goal always to just make a splash and then, you know, go...
But her goal was never to make a splash. It was part of the secret of her charm, was she just was herself and she had no ambition.
She was a working girl. She just wanted to get paid to pay her rent.
Right, and... but when I met her, I thought she, in 1996, she was, I guess, close to 70. She looked great. A little heavier, a little fuller in the face, a little bit of gray hair, but still the same bangs. She looked great. Now, she did not want to be seen in public. She said, I want to be remembered the way I was then.
No videotaping, no filming.
I have such great respect for that. You know, Dolly Parton was once on David Letterman, and he was like, just recently, you ever just go and like pick up the newspaper at the front of your mansion? She was like, never. I would never do that. And they were like, why? She's like, because you don't know what I look like in the morning, and I owe that to my fans, because there's like 500 people out there all the time. I'm not going to go looking like or something. I had great respect for that kind of... desire to not have to always come back for a comeback. And
She was terribly exploited as a term. I mean, everybody made money in the end, but her. And then she had a little bit of a break. She had some problems. She was married.
Well, and one of the things we go into in the film that she's never talked about publicly before is she spent 10 years in a mental institution.
Ooh, really?
Yes, she was actually charged with attempted murder and diagnosed as paranoid schizophrenic.
What?
It's incredible.
Oh, my God. And what do you think it was attributed? Would you attribute the kind of social, you know, the conservative right, you know, having power back then and making her feel like she had done something wrong? Or was this just a genetic predisposition that would have come out no matter what?
Well, I think it's complex, and I think all of these things are involved. But certainly the persecution in the 50s fed her paranoia, I think, and it's what drove her out of the business.
It seems that she was legitimately surprised by it too, because she thought it was just she. I mean, in Mark's documentary that I've seen clips of and various cuts, she talks about kind of laughing at these guys. She'd have people sort of sending her clothes and sort of having her put on a saddle and stirrups and to take pictures. She thought it was a big joke. And
she
of
thought
course,
it was normal.
Yeah, I mean, she thought she was playing.
She made no judgment about it.
Yeah. It was not at all in any way. You know, she didn't anyway. I mean, as far as pornography or even prostitution, she wasn't at all like that. There's very few, actually it's very rare, any sort of naked photos of her, even despite how many pictures have been taken of her.
And I see a lot of parallels with the first black heavyweight champion in America. I forget. I don't want to get his name wrong. It's not
Joe Louis?
No. Is it Joe Louis? It was a very big guy. Anyway.
Jack Johnson.
Jack Johnson, back in the
turn. Exactly.
Right.
And he was, you know, arrested for, you know, prostitution, for taking a woman across state lines.
Right.
And he was
a white woman's position.
Well, he had to go move to Europe, and all these European countries refused him. He eventually was avoiding having to go to jail for 3 years, and so he was in Mexico for like 5-6 years. He's like, you know, I need to get back. I'll do my 2 years. Of course, he was very charismatic, but I mean, there was a lot of hatred for that type
of
liberation.
Well, that's a good lead into the next clip we have of Betty talking, because she talks about getting arrested.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
One time we got arrested, though. We were upstate New York on a farm, and some of the neighbors saw us, the girls topless, and called the police, and here came a squad car.
Calling car 6 and 7/8. Car 6 and 7/8.
Hauled us down to the courthouse in this little town. I thought surely I was going to jail. And the judge, all he did was chew us out for indecent exposure. I don't even believe God disapproves of nudity. After all, he put Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden naked as jaybirds.
Amen.
Who would call the cops on a naked woman? They should be arrested. That's ridiculous.
Well, and what's funny in that story is this was one of those camera clubs that you asked me about earlier. Back in the 50s, it was illegal to send nude pictures through the mail.
Right.
So you'd get 20 guys on a weekend would pay $5 each. They'd take three or four models, go out some isolated place and photograph them. She's describing one of these incidents. But some of the photographers that were doing this were Ouija, Gordon Parks, other people like
major
this.
Major people.
Right. But they got arrested in this particular situation. So Betty, they all just wanted to plead guilty and get out of there. But Betty held everything up for hours because she refused to plead guilty because she didn't think she did anything wrong.
Oh, really? That's so funny.
She's awesome. But it's an interesting reference, actually, at the end of that. She references Adam and Eve to talk about her turn to Christianity, to the very people who are persecuting fundamentalism, actually.
Well, even she always considered herself to be a Christian. And she became saved in 1957, right after she left modeling. And we have her telling that story in the film. And then she always considered herself a Christian. And she would not try to proselytize, at least she didn't with me. Mm. But she had very strong beliefs. And she would make references to the Bible like she did Adam and Eve, it's okay to be naked.
Mm-hmm.
But at her funeral in 2008, which I was the only one allowed to film, it was officiated by Reverend Robert Schuller.
Interesting.
Of the Crystal Cathedral.
Positive misrespect.
Gigantic, yes. But a gigantic following. I mean, huge. He's gigantic.
And he in his interview, he said Betty Page did nothing wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting.
Fantastic. It's sad that, so much... I mean, she was a real revolutionary because she paved the way, right? I mean,
she was, and as true revolutionaries, she was unaware of her action. She just was, meaning it wasn't sort of, she didn't set out to change anything. She just did.
Completely uncalculated.
Yeah. Completely uncalculated.
Beowulf was just like, I'm a strong guy. She was just like, I'm unbelievably hot and I want to pay my rent. Like, that's so noble.
Unapologetic, as she should have been, and died in relative, not I wouldn't say poverty, but was it...
Well, it wasn't until the last 15 years of her life that she began to get some money. Many people got rich off of her through the years.
And did they eventually, some of them, make nice?
Some of them, I mean, there's a whole controversial story about even when she started to come back into the public eye, people were still ripping her off. But she eventually got enough money to live very comfortably.
So that's nice. So, I mean, are there a few names of people who, like... You know, there was some ethical thing in them that
Dave
they were like,
Stevens,
I have to stop.
Dave Stevens, who drew the Rocketeer comic book that was made into a Disney movie in 1991, was probably her closest friend, one of the people responsible for bringing her back into the public, helping her get some of her money and that kind of stuff. There
Great.
Was a few people around like that.
Great, because there was no real network. There was no real web of... She was a pioneer, so it's not like she could fall into an established role. I mean, she was just...
Well, and she isolated herself. She walked away from the modeling, and then she was in this mental institution. It was only when she came out.
Mm-hmm.
It was about the same time that the public began to really rediscover. It was basically on the internet that she was discovered by young people.
Hmm. Yeah, she's got a huge following now. Mark, talk about... Are we up for a break shortly? And we can talk about the sort of the distribution model.
I think we are up for a break. So let's take a break and we'll come back.
Great.
Jump the truth.
All right, we're back with Mark Mori.
I'm going to drop a drop. Is everyone ready in the back? I'm going to do a drop. Nat?
This is Joe Bastianich, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Wow.
That's pretty cool. And today we're brought to you by Paradise Locker Meats. If you're anywhere near Trimble or Kansas City, Missouri, stop by. They have great food that you can eat there. And
it's the show me state. Drop in. Tell them to show me.
Bring it on.
Yeah.
Well, this is a fascinating. By the way, we have already sitting in case he chimes in, there's another voice. It'll be Chris Paracchini, who is doing our first segment on New York waterways.
And one of the owners of this fabulous establishment here, Roberta's.
Roberta's.
On North Moore Street.
We're talking about one of the most fascinating, I mean, literally one of the most recognizable faces in history, probably.
Right. Actually, her face is probably more recognizable than her name. Once you put the name together with the face, then you go, oh, yeah. I mean, she's so dominant in the culture once you realize her pervasive, I guess.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it goes throughout. I mean, we just started off with Kim Cattrall and Sherilyn Fenn and Madonna.
In Quentin Tarantino's movie Pulp Fiction is based on Betty Page, the Uma Thurman character.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's
fantastic. That was a great role.
Mark, talk about your model, how you got interested in this and what you're doing. I mean, there's a huge internet database on her, people who are just so fascinated with her.
Well, yes, she was discovered on the internet. She's really an internet phenomenon. People just discovered all these photographs of her, and that's really all most people know about her. And there are millions of fans all over the world on our website, BettyPageMovie.com. We have people from 74 countries coming to the website. She's just has this massive following all the world. So the film is now in the finishing stages. It'll be coming out probably in 2010. Mm-hmm. But what we're doing, besides the traditional distribution in theaters and so forth, we're also doing a bottom-up grassroots campaign where we're drawing Betty Page fans in to help promote the film. There's a lot of burlesque dancers that see Betty Page as their mm-hmm. hero. They show a little clip from the film in their shows all over the country. And so it's just we're doing a kind of grassroots viral marketing mm-hmm. with the movie.
Now, how did she feel about the supermodels, the Farrah Fawcett's, the Elle McPherson's? Right. Did she see herself as having broken some doors open?
No,
for that?
She did not understand what she did. She couldn't understand why people were interested in her. I mean, this was actually, I think, part of the reason it worked so well with her, because she had no self-awareness, no ambition, no design to her. And that's what comes through in the photographs. So she couldn't understand why all these, I mean, she liked it, but she couldn't understand why all these people were modeling themselves mm-hmm. on her, why they said she was so great, all this kind of thing, which is, we explore all that in the film.
Right, of course. And where are we going to be able to see this film?
Well, the film should be released in the art house circuit in theaters, but it will definitely be available on DVD. You can get it on the website and in all the usual places.
And do you have a website where, I know you just told us where people can find updates on
BettyPageMovie.com. There's a lot of stuff on there right now. People can participate. They can find out.
You're on Facebook.
MySpace.
Do you Twitter?
Twitter. We have a Betty Page Movie on Twitter.
Another Twitter.
Yeah, she is huge. I mean, it's amazing. Her story is, the fact that she took, it's always like that, right? James Dean, 3 films, right? It's like, we're still talking about him, right? Betty Page.
It's like Marilyn Monroe in the sense that she disappeared.
Princess
and
Di.
People tried to find her and they couldn't find her for 40 years. And so, she's was so reclusive. She's never come out and told her own story.
She's like J.D. Salinger.
Right.
J.D. Salinger only knows the word through lawsuits. slap a lawsuit. J.D., I hope you are listening. If you do one last interview, please make it at Roberta's. You will love this place.
Good beer and pizza.
Food of all types. What would we ask?
J.D. Salinger?
He's like, I'm here. You asked for me. I'm here.
Where have you been for the last 40 years? That's what the first
Do you remember Betty Page?
Do you remember? What did you think about
that? That was the 50s, right?
Yeah, that's probably right. He's like, he probably came out of hiding.
God, that'd be awesome. Actually, Mark and I once talked about writing a movie, and I think we talked about going north to visit some author. Yeah. I mean, did we know about J.D.?
Just like in Field of Dreams. Show up at his door.
Yeah.
Get away from us.
What's up, dude?
So, Mark, talk about what was the scene like at her funeral? It was a little bit of a theater.
Well, it was
experience.
It was because you had Reverend Robert Schuller officiating, And you had Hugh Hefner in the front door. I mean, in the front row. So this was the first meeting between Hefner and Shuler.
And amazing. Remember, she was, you said earlier, in Playboy in its first year of existence.
Yes, she was in Playboy. And Hefner was very fond of Betty Page. I mean, bet. He came to be her champion. He's the one of the people that helped her get the money she was due in the later years.
Interesting. Good for him.
Yeah. And they just did recently a feature on Betty after her death. But there was also all these Betty Page lookalikes at the funeral. You know, that's a big
phenomenon. In L.A. It was in L.A., right?
Right, it was in L.A., yeah.
So what was the funeral like? People were performing?
No, people weren't performing. Oh. I mean, if you call what Shuler does performing, then...
But who came?
Or dressing up as such.
Was it invitation
only. Did
she have
kids?
She had no children.
Okay.
But she had three nieces there. And one of the interesting things up, an unheard-from nephew that the other nieces didn't know, hadn't seen, they weren't sure if he was really...
Just trying to get some money?
They thought that at first when he showed up at the funeral, yeah.
And did he turn out to be real?
He turned out to be the real deal. And he didn't know that his father, Betty's brother, had died recently, and the nieces did, and he found out at her funeral.
Wow.
Well, you definitely are the Heritage Radio Network's Betty Page expert. There's no one else that will ever dethrone that. Mark, what a fascinating...
It's the only documentary. Has anybody done a documentary on her?
Well... E did a horrible thing about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Some expose.
Besides E.
With horrible reenactments in it, you know.
Yeah, she was talking. That was very funny. The HBO film, if people aren't familiar, HBO did a film on her, and she was really angry about it, right?
She saw it at the Playboy Mansion.
It's a very funny story.
That's where they played it for her?
They played it for her at the Playboy Mansion, and she didn't even like the name Notorious in the title, the Notorious Betty Page. And a guy who was there told me the story. She's sitting in the back of the theater. The movie gets going, and all of a sudden, from the back of the theater, you hear, "Lies, lies, lies." So she was not very fond of that movie, and I have to say it did not really get at who Betty Page really was.
Yeah, because they think she's like this sex kitten, or you know, that's how she's taken publicly, but she really wasn't like that at all.
I think when people find out who the real Betty Page is, they're going to be really surprised in many ways. They're going to find out about her warts, but they're also going to maybe, I think, understand her greatness in a way that they haven't before.
Did she have a good sense of humor?
She had a great sense of humor, yeah. I mean, I think you can catch that a little bit in the couple of clips that we just heard.
Yeah, she's very funny. And she basically, after she got out of the hospital, she was okay. I mean, seemingly, right? I mean, she basically she got her life together, at least in the sense of being able to put...
I mean, she lived the way she wanted to. She stayed at home and watched her old movies. You know, she liked Turner Classic Movies, and that's what she did with her time. So.
Me and Betty Page got that in common.
Yeah.
Well, what an arousing interview. I mean, I think that was just absolutely fantastic.
Thank you, guys.
Arousing is the word.
I'm sorry if I was a little ejaculatory earlier. But no, Betty Page, and thank you for, you know, bringing justice to it. I mean, there's so much that's happened within these past 50 years, and certainly, you know, sexual revolution and, you know, contraception, you know, the pill. I mean, oh, my God, like that changed so much. And she was right there, and it took society a little to catch up.
Yeah.
You know,
she allowed millions of women to feel comfortable in their sexuality.
Yeah, really. Well, thank you so much. I hope you come back. Today's show is brought to you by Paradise Locker Meats. And when we come back, we're going to talk about a new segment, New York Waterways.
Awesome. Back with Chris. At the queue, we're steaming off a little bit from the Betty Page segment.
Mark Marabella, you might hear an air conditioner in the back.
I wish. I'm Mark Marabella.
I'm Patrick Martins.
We're here at the Q Report.
Q stands for Quotidian. We're at Roberta's at 261 Moore Street. Restaurant / pizzeria.
/ radio station studio.
/ concert venue. And
/ patio.
Patio.
Beer hall.
Social nexus.
Pizza oven.
Garden. Other than that, there's not much going on.
Not much
on.
Happening.
Yeah. So we are doing a segment on New York waterways. We were joking earlier, like our first segment would be a New York waterways, since that's how we discovered the New World, you know, from Europe, was through its waterways. So Chris Parrachini is the founder of Roberta's and has become an avid sailor. Tell us, what boat do you have and where do you sail?
I'm partners in a 1981 S2 8-meter sloop, and it's I'm partners with five other people. We've got it moored at Gateway Marina, which is at the end of Flatbush Avenue in Brooklyn, just before you go over the Marine Parkway Bridge to get to Breezy Point or Fort Tilden.
What waterway is that there? Does it go towards the Atlantic, doesn't it?
Yeah, we're in Dead Horse Bay, and just outside the bay is Plum Beach Channel. And just outside Plum Beach Channel is the Breezy Point Inlet and the Atlantic Ocean.
It's close to between, that's just for people geographically, it's between JFK and Coney Island, right?
Yes,
wow,
exactly.
Real New York centric.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when you picked up this boat, yeah, first of all, it's a sailboat, right?
Right. Yeah.
Is that what true sailing is? Is sailing?
Well, a sloop is a shallow, explain what a sloop is.
A sloop is, well, a sloop, aka a Bermuda rigged sailboat or a Marconi rigged sailboat, is basically got one mainsail and one foresail or a jib sail, and it's a triangular rig, and they're basically, they perform best to windward or sailing into the wind.
Shallow bottom. It's designed for speed and shallow waterways
and maneuverability.
Local. Riverboat or just offshore, right? Is, you know, you wouldn't sail across the Atlantic theoretically.
You could. There are better sail plan setups to do that. But yeah, it's. You could, and it's been done before, and will be done again. But it's. They were also. I think that. They were basically coastal boats, and I don't think they really came into their own until pirates in the Caribbean discovered them and how awesome they were for their maneuverability, speed to wind, etc. And they, you know, that's kind of where they really got off the ground as a competitive sailboat.
So how many people, do you captain the boat? How many people are on the boat at any one time?
Anywhere from, I haven't single-handed it yet. I usually wind up captaining it. Sometimes other people do too. Everyone's got a job usually, and 4 to 6 is like the ideal crew.
Have you ever tipped over?
No. On the 4th of July, we had about 10 people on the boat, and it was blowing like 25 knots of wind.
Wow.
And we had too much sail up, and we almost capsized twice. But,
wow, where were you?
In Plum Beach Channel.
The word escapes me now.
Water?
No. the thing on the bottom.
Keel.
Do you have a deep keel? You probably don't.
No, it's only drafting 4 feet of water.
Right, so it's potentially, it's not going to hang there for you.
Right.
You're not going to tip too far.
I think we were about, the mast tip was about 4 feet away from being in the water.
Oh my
God. So it was like, you know, it didn't get horrendous, but it was a little too close for comfort.
And, wow.
We had the boat overloaded and we had way too much sail up and, it was a great learning experience.
where were you on the 4th to watch the fireworks somewhere?
Yeah, we were off Coney Island. We were supposed to be up in the harbor, but by the time we took off to sail up into New York Harbor, we were too late. So we just
Do they close it? How does that work? Do they close it on the 4th, or just too far away?
Not at all. You can sail up there. I mean, there are restricted areas, and obviously you can't get too close to the barges. But
I was out of the city for the 4th. Where did they have fireworks? I heard it was on the Hudson this year.
The
Hudson, right?
Yeah.
Let me ask, what is the New York water like? Is it rough? Like, I know the Cape of Good Hope and her Horn, you know, all those are rough.
Yeah.
Like, what is New York? Because it is where a lot of Hudson meets the ocean, and
yeah, there are some points all along the New York City waterways that are kind of, I wouldn't call them rough, but can are kind of like provide for a spirited experience, like Hellgate, which is where
you crossed Hellgate, didn't you?
Yeah, when we brought the boat back from the North Fork, uh-huh. Which is basically where the Long Island Sound dumps all its water into the East River. Or all that East River water floods out to the Sound.
How long then, did that run take you?
Almost 2 days. I think it was like 38 hours when it was all.
What do they call it, Hellgate? That I can only imagine.
Interestingly enough, it was Hellgate. It has some like Dutch origin and means nothing about hell or a gate. It has something else to do
it's
with
like Brooklyn, right?
Yeah, and I don't know exactly what it is, but some Dutch explorer named it Hellgate way back when, and then it just sort of turned out to be a very fitting name for it, because it's one of the more treacherous areas in the New York City waterways, just because the river constricts, a lot of water moves through it, it flows around an island, it has these crazy rock pillars on the bottom that create weird sort of currents and like minor maelstroms and weird stuff like that.
I love
and the traffic
word
of
maelstrom.
Course in the East River, it can be crazy.
I know. There's a lot
so
of big boats.
So strong. In the East River, I mean, if you've ever been on, if you go over the 59th Street Bridge and you look down or you're on Roosevelt Island, I mean, there's a wake at the tip of that island. Mm-hmm. I mean, depending on which side of the island, too, which way the river's flowing at that particular moment, it's so strong.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing and swirling, too.
Yeah, I'd like to ask you, I mean, if you were given, an invitation to the White House and, or to talk to the Senate committee about making an argument for funding more sailing initiatives for kids out there. I mean, what do you think is the experience that teenage kids could go if they reacquainted themselves with such an important transportation means in the water?
Yeah, I think it would be amazing. I mean, I think it needs to happen. It's sailing is like, I feel like almost all the life skills you need to get through are all present. I mean, prudence, proper planning, navigational skills, teamwork, understanding your role on a team, understanding why your own job is so important. And then, of course, like, it's sort of like all of these work skills, because sailing is work, you know, and it's without, I mean, it's, you know, it really existed for commerce forever. And now doing it for pleasure is cool and all, but it's still work. And to be able to work that hard, all to sort of like tune yourself in the boat to a natural energy and harness it, I think is something that any kid anywhere or adult would benefit from, you know?
What role does your business partner Gabe play? What's his ideal role on the boat?
Yeah. Well, he's one of the owners of the boat. And, I mean, when he's on, I think he usually sheets or, works the winches.
Sheets his pants?
I don't know.
He puts them up the jib. That's amazing.
Everyone gets a job on the boat.
What do you think?
Gabe's been the helmsman a few times too. I mean, everybody gets a chance to kind of do everything.
Sloop, there it is. Yeah. Sloop, there it is.
Oh my god.
The other interesting thing is this is probably the best time to buy boats in the last, I don't know, maybe 20 years, maybe longer for
probably
obvious
because
reasons.
Of people who got greedy and now the downfall of the economy and all.
Yeah, sure. Yeah,
awesome.
I mean, it's just, there's a lot, yeah.
Is it expensive to have it in New York? Is it more or less? I mean, boats are expensive no matter where they are because of the upkeep and slips, et cetera. And we're in a northern region, so do you have to, you can't keep it in all the year, or you do? What about that?
Well, this will be our first winter coming up. So I don't know what we're going to do yet. We need to do some major repairs on the boat this winter, so we're probably going to put it on the hard for at least some portion of the winter and fix it. I don't know. It depends on how you look at it. I mean, it costs us just a couple of $1,000s to keep a 26-foot boat berthed in Brooklyn. So, and I don't know where that falls on the scale of in the whole marina world. I would imagine places in City Island are probably more expensive.
Places in San Diego are probably cheaper.
Or probably
or
more.
Or not. I don't
or
know.
Really?
Yeah, but it's a big sailing town.
Yeah.
It's on the ocean.
Well, that's what I was saying. Like, if everyone sails, does it become cheaper or more expensive?
Oh, I don't know. You know, it's interesting. The East Coast, too, Chris. I mean, you know, having been in Norfolk and the whole intercoastal, there's a lot of water around New York, of course. You have, maybe here you have a lot of more options than you would in other places because there are so many. Just, I mean, Brooklyn and Queens alone, let alone Long Island and Connecticut or New Jersey.
Yeah.
Even around the city. City Island, as you mentioned, which is part of the Bronx, technically, up in the East River, Harlem River. Is it Harlem River? Technically, at that point, I don't know.
No.
Don't you want to ask the inventor of the New York City trivia game?
I would.
I don't know, by
Patrick.
The way.
It's not that expensive. When it really, for the five of us to share the boat and share the expenses of the boat and put the time in is really, it's been a pleasure, honestly. I mean, a lot of people prepared us. When they heard we were getting it by, you know, telling us you're going to be throwing money into a hole, you're throwing your life away. You're going to die.
It's like worse than Betty Page.
it hasn't been any of those things.
All the naysayers. You heard the same thing when you tried to open up a restaurant, too, I'm sure.
So many naysayers. People with slow food. I mean, we were 2-3 years in. They were like, you're not going to make it.
It's a very interesting story. The we were talking about America's Lost H-Bomb before.
Yeah.
This physicist who I interviewed for the, you know, they were talking about detecting nuclear bombs coming into San Francisco. And so he took me on his, he's like, you want to sail across the San Francisco Harbor? I'm like, yeah, sure.
Why not?
And he's a physicist. This guy is literally a rocket scientist, a nuclear scientist. And he was like, sailing is just fantastic because it's very physical. It's working on the physics, but of nature. You have to think about how you're doing it. And San Francisco Bay has some treacherous spots too. It's like high wakes and weird little jetties and rocks and, but he loved it. I mean, it was amazing too. And this old spindly guy who's like, you know, you think he's almost frail, and he looks like this, and he is. He's smart as you know. He's working. You know, he's in our, you know, protecting the country and figuring out if North Korea has nuclear weapons. And he looks like this bookish figure, and he gets out there, and he's like keeling, and like me and my cameraman are like almost losing our lunch on it. No, seriously. And he was like, he's totally digging it. You know, totally comes alive because it's just the wind. Literally, it's like the first means of transportation.
Yeah, I mean they were the first astronauts too.
Exactly, exactly. You're not even exaggerating. Maybe even worse.
I mean, from the dawn of man. I mean, look just beyond the horizon. What was there? You know, I mean, it was everything. And some people made like historic journeys. Like I was reading in Jared Diamond's Guns, Germs, and Steel. Mm-hmm. Like there are people living in like certain Pacific islands that just shouldn't be there, you know, like there's a Chinese or Leif Erikson, you know, somehow making it here and starting a primitive settlement.
It's true.
There were some real feats. And I was talking with Chris about Captain Bligh after the famous mutiny was supposedly one of the greatest acts of seafaring ever was his weaving through the enemy islands off memory. He was all his books had been taken from him. You know, pretty crazy.
I mean, it's amazing that, and they did that by the stars. What? Are you? It's like, I can't even get Google to work and I'm freaking out, you know, I'm pulling over. I'm like, they did it by the, I'm like, that's unbelievable.
I can't even find the entrance to the BQE.
You got to be kidding me. Yeah. I mean, it's really spectacular. And the people who do it have a great passion for it. It is truly an art. I mean, it'll go on forever. I mean,
forever.
If you're my business partner too, I don't know if you met Julie, but she was a sailor forever. She lived
from Canada to Jamaica.
She sailed down Montreal, from Montreal all the way intercoastal seaway down to the Caribbean, and she, you know, she dealt with pirates. And
but by the way,
she lived in a boat for 7 years by herself.
My friend Wu told me this interesting story. I always thought sailing was the best escape mechanism for you know, mummies and stuff, you know, kind of like the dead. But apparently, they can walk just on the sea bottom. So you can sail to safety, but a year or two later, they're going to eventually get there.
That's true. I guess the River Styx is no real impediment to between the living and the dead.
Yeah, so it's not just a fix-all solution. It'll buy you some time.
But Chris, for those listening, and obviously New York is surrounded by water, and it's coming down on us right now.
Yeah.
Where's your favorite place to sail that you've sailed around in the New York waterways?
Or the most challenging, too.
Yeah, one of the two.
It's hard to say. It really depends on the day, the conditions for the day. You know, it's such a... That's the neat thing about it is you can go to the same place day in, day out, and you kind of, it's always different. The tide's different, the current's different, the wind direction and speed are different, the amount of traffic, what you're trying to achieve by being there, etc. So New York Harbor can be really exciting or really boring. I mean, it you know, you never know. It's easy for us to get out into the Atlantic. We've a lot of times we can just sneak out in the afternoon and we'll like zip down to Sandy Hook and back just in a few hours. I think the greatest trip for me so far has been the original, the maiden voyage for us was taking it from Southold on the North Fork of Long Island all the way down the Sound into New York Harbor and then to Gateway.
And I saw them on 55th.
Yeah, it was fantastic. Really? Yeah, Patrick came out and stood on the East River.
I was like, can I throw like some cookies onto your boat? They're like a little dangerous.
Yeah. That's a pretty amazing trip, 2 days.
It was great. And it got me, it really got me interested in, there's going to be more. I mean, and eventually I think I'm going to try and get onto a serious crew for the Newport to Bermuda race.
Wow.
Really?
Hopefully next year. But very if not intense. Next
good
year,
for you,
year,
Chris. So, yeah. Favorite explorer, Mark?
Favorite explorer? Neil Armstrong.
All right. I guess space qualifies. I was going to say in Seinfeld, it was... DeSoto. George said DeSoto. Jerry's like, what? Who the hell cares about DeSoto? But I actually like Vasco da Gama. Because Magellan, too much. Plus he died like around the world back in those times. But around Africa to the...
Magellan, like, Magellan opened up the Philippines, too, for the Spanish as well.
Did he? Mm-hmm. But he died.
Yeah.
I mean, it was too long. 4 or 5 years. I mean, I wouldn't be that dedicated. Year and a half, too, around the Cape of Africa. It was pretty cool.
Yeah, it's amazing, mm-hmm. actually. I have to say, my...
Portuguese, he was.
The New York waterways. My first job when I got to New York was working... I was a captain, a waiter captain on a boat on World Yacht, which at the time came from the Chelsea Piers, which became, they moved up to the 42nd. But I always remember, you know, it was basically a very fine dining experience for tourists to come and look at the statue. But there were some days where we couldn't go. I mean, and these are like gigantic tour boats, right? With huge kitchens. I mean, huge. You know, these would hold, you know, we had, our biggest boat was 1,000 people.
Wow.
And, you know, there were some nights where we couldn't go out because it was so choppy. We would, you know, launch from the Hudson, for people that don't know, those piers on the west side, and then go into the New York waterway. But if it was too choppy, you know, smashing the boat against the pier. So, you know, you get your sea legs. There's some people who couldn't handle it. But,
how many,
you know, holding
people,
a tray on a boat is a definitely an interesting thing.
How many people need to be, like, fall out of commission before you would have to take over the boat?
That's an interesting question.
247. Could happen.
It could happen.
I wasn't. That's another, I was in the chain, though. I was like, you know, the local. It was like, you know, taking over the presidency.
Yeah. It could happen as the punchline to a Walter Cronkite joke. Two Irish guys walk out of a bar.
Mm-hmm.
It could happen. So, all right. Well, we're coming towards the end. But do you have any wrap up thoughts that you wanted to tell us, Chris?
Yeah, a couple of things actually just came to mind. One is a couple of friends around town have been either finding old dinghies, mostly rowing dinghies, or building them actually out of plywood, and it doesn't take much. And, you know, there are launches, some of them clandestine, some of them not, but all over the city. And to see the city from the water again, you know, New York's been in and out of my life my whole life, but mm-hmm. I've been back now since 2002, and... You know, when you look at the same places day in, day out, you can sort of start to, you start missing some of the details. But mm-hmm. to see the city again from the waterways, or I should say for the first time from the waterways, has totally opened my eyes.
Interesting.
Again, to like what the city is. And the amazing thing about being on the waterways is that you can see all of the city infrastructure from that level. Like all of its guts are all at water level, whether it's, you know, sewage, power, gas. Whatever. And then there are all of these sort of most of them abandoned, not all of them, some of them still working, but like New York used to also get to work on the water, and they used mm-hmm. to work on, New Yorkers used to work on the water, get to work by water, and all that stuff is still there. And it's like between the new angles and seeing things that are part of the city that I never would have seen otherwise, it's just been like a whole another, it's just opened up a whole new world. And boats are easy, you know, that you just... I would swim. I would know how to swim before I got on one. But other than that, just, you know.
And they
know.
Use if no can, gas, right? No.
They can use no gas. Yeah, a rowboat, a sailboat. Yeah, we have a little 15 horsepower motor that we use to motor in and out of the marina. But as soon as we're outside the marina, we raise sails and sail pretty much everywhere we go.
It's a safety issue too. You know, yeah. To have it just in case.
Just
anything,
in case
anything happens, just to get out of it.
The movie Jaws created that rule.
They couldn't travel very far. on a 15 horsepower, but they can maneuver with it.
True. Did you guys see, what was that movie? What kind of fish are there in the waterways here? Like, this isn't real shark country, is it? That's more south of here. Or is it?
South and north, just farther out. We're the continental shelf in this part of the world is pretty, goes out pretty far, so the water's pretty shallow for a ways, and just not super conducive to sharks. But there's bluefish, there's porgies, there's striped bass, there's fluke.
Porgy is the best.
You like porgy? Porgy and bass?
And occasionally somebody...
Mark rolled his eyes.
There's a lot of fishermen, actually. There's a great documentary on people fishing around the waterways in New York. And, of course, there's actually even over JFK, around JFK...
Jamaica Bay.
They're all there's still oyster fishermen over there. And a lot of it's preserved waterways.
100%, yeah.
Yeah, wildlife refuge. There's a bird sanctuary. I mean, people don't know this in New York, and the waterway is something you can see from the boat that you wouldn't be able to see otherwise.
Yeah.
There's a lot of really interesting natural environments, believe it or not, around New York that are preserved. I mean, the people, if you look at a map on the East Coast, it looks like this very sort of, you know, dark, sharp line from the Atlantic to from Maine to Florida. But in reality, it's very permeable. There's a lot of swamps and inlets and rivers. And
Washington, D.C. is a swamp.
Yeah, it's all very marshy islands all the way up and down the East Coast. So it's a lot of interesting things to see from the waterway that you wouldn't see otherwise from the land.
I mean, we're driving around in a convertible in the city is also does
yeah,
that.
That's
it's just,
true.
It's just something new different than the quotidian. Yeah. Not that I'm bashing on quotidian or anything.
No, we love quotidian. It's quotidian plus.
Well, plus plus. This has been a great show. Betty Page, wow, a cultural icon. I'm going to go home.
A brunette, too. Proud brunette with her bangs.
I am going to go home, lock my bedroom door, and listen to that interview again.
It's fantastic.
While watching posters of her. Just kidding.
You like the spanking ones, right, Patrick? The one with the big leather boots.
So, no, Betty Page, what a cultural icon. It's too bad in her lifetime she didn't get the appreciation or the money that she deserved, although towards the end, people like Hugh Hefner gave her her due.
Yeah, Hugh knows. He's been around long enough. He knows the true icons.
And thanks to Chris for starting off our segment series, New York Waterways.
It's good for
thanks
the summer.
For yeah.
Thanks, Chris. Always
right,
a pleasure.
We'll be back next week with the show that will be determined right before airtime.
Thanks for listening.